a debt. And that was okay, too.
We're good. Let's go.
Go with love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too.
We're going to swap a couple things around here, and instead of going directly into the offertory, we're going to go into the helping hands. Second Sunday of each month, we invite someone from the community or somebody from within our congregation to come up and explain or refresh our memories on a local charity that we have asked to come in and tell us. All the monies gathered today, unless otherwise, unless you designate that it's for UUFM only, will go to this fund. And the one we have today is Betty Banner is going to tell us about the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund. So,
good morning. This fellowship has generously supported this fund over a number of years, and many of you know about it. But we have a lot of new members, so some of this may be repetitive. The mission of this fund is to assist Kansas women who are seeking an abortion and need financial assistance to be able to afford their procedures. The women that we assist are pregnant, have determined that the termination of the pregnancy is in the best interest for them, and have limited resources in order to pay for it. In 2016, we provided assistance to 283 Kansas women. There are three abortion clinics in Kansas, but we also work with clinics in several states. What this does is it ensures women who need to travel out of state, either because of nearer distances, such as Western Kansas, where Colorado offers a closer clinic, or because the pregnancy is later on and they must seek a clinic that provides late-term services. Once the clinic determines what the status of the woman's pregnancy, the kind of procedure that's needed, and her financial resources, if they determine that financial assistance is needed, they contact our fund. You probably know there are a lot of barriers to abortion services, and Kansas is notorious as amongst the most conservative. And I was appalled to see, even this week in the paper, there was a legislator who submitted a bill that said any woman who was seeking an abortion in this state would have to be provided with information about the physician's malpractice insurance. How many of you have ever been offered information or even asked about the malpractice insurance that your medical provider carries? Crazy. So what happens with all these barriers is sometimes women have to, number one, really identify that that services are available. And then secondly, for low-income women in particular, gather together funds to hurdle over barriers that mid- and upper-income women don't have to face. Things like reliable transportation to get to a clinic, or being able to get off work because they don't have vacation or sick pay, or if they don't come when scheduled, might be fired. And the consequence of that is both trauma to the woman, but also frequently it results in a later term procedure because she's been trying to gather together. So our fund has a twofold mission. One is to provide those financial services and assistance to women, but the other is to try and maintain an awareness of the availability of abortion services and how to access them. And one of the ways we do this is, for the past 20 years, this fund has operated a pro-choice booth at the Kansas State Fair. It's a big deal. In the same building, there are 5 pro-life vendors. The fair is 10 days in length, and the fair operations require that any booth be fully staffed from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. for 10 days. That means we need 60 people to staff our booth in pairs of 2 for 4-hour shifts. So this year, in addition to asking for your financial support, we're asking if the UUFM would be willing to support 2 days of operation of this fair booth. And I will tell you, I've done it for a number of years, and it really is a lot of fun. Susan Adamczyk, who's in the back, is another board member on our fund, and Susan and I will be glad to help provide a little bit of training to you. If you're hesitant about it, we'll make sure you're prepared to go. But we would appreciate that as a social action initiative. You know, we're reaching out. And so that is another way that you can provide assistance. If you are interested, please see Susan or I, and we'll begin to gather some names and see how it is. The fair is on the Friday after Labor Day for 10 days following, and it is this year the 8th to the 17th of September. So I would appreciate this morning your financial donations to help those women in need, and also your interest in the fair. And I'll be happy to answer any questions or discuss the fund at the coffee hour. Thank you.
Thank you. we've gotten rather generous with our applause, haven't we? You know, there was a time that we talked about trying to have some quiet and calm, but oh well. And the light has gone out, the chalice has gone out, but it hasn't really gone out. I mean, it's gone out here, but it hasn't gone out in our hearts, and I'm sure that it's low on oil, probably. A few times each year, we welcome new members into our fellowship, and today we're going to welcome 5 new members. She's going to eke out of it whatever she can. Huh? All right. And so I'd invite them to come forward as I say a little something about them. Shannon Skelton comes to us from Wisconsin, where he had some involvement with the First Unitarian Society there. And I think his wife, Gretchen, grew up here, but she isn't here this weekend. Shannon serves as a professor in the theater department. Rob Morrison and Emily Frazier moved here from Michigan by way of West Virginia. They were active with the UU Church in Kalamazoo and moved so that Rob could take a job as an entomologist with the USDA. And Emily's already joined the UU Singers, as has Jess Finkemeyer, who is foster son to Linda Krager and Mike Herman, and found his commitment to UUism quickly. And finally, Angie Bauer moved here from Kansas City and is a foster parent and disability rights activist and is partnered with our established member, Laura Lott. So we're glad to have all of you. Membership in this fellowship is simple because all that's required is to sign our membership book. We hold no creed. Nothing has to be recited. But membership in a UU congregation is difficult because you've joined a community searching for truth when truth can be elusive. Membership means you are part of a congregation struggling for justice, knowing that the struggle can be long. Membership means that you have joined with a people who strive to live in loving relationship with others, and these are not easy things to do. So, do you, the new members of this congregation, freely enter into membership in this congregation?
Yes.
All right. And to the gathered congregation, each new face and each new voice that joins with us brings with it joys and sorrows, skills and abilities, thoughts and beliefs. With every new member, we become a new congregation. Do you accept these people into membership fully aware that the nature of this religious body is evolving? All right. We then accept each of you into our ranks, and we formally extend to you the sincere welcome of our fellowship, mindful of the bond which already exists between us and the hope of that bond growing stronger every day. And I think Shirley has things to give you as a symbol of that bond. Do you need help with that or her?
No.
You got it.
Shannon.
I'll go down.
Jess Finkemeyer.
All right, y'all may be seated. Joining is but a beginning. We have a demonstration of that this morning as we are going to hear from a couple of our newer members, and we look forward to becoming a new and more diverse congregation thanks to the presence of each of our members, no matter how long you have been here. Please know, though, that churches are never perfect. A time may come when the fellowship disappoints you. A time may come when through action or inaction you fail the fellowship. But please know that the covenant among us offers the hope and miracle of healing as long as we stay in relationship with each other. The power of covenant does not go so far as to say it doesn't matter what happened. It does assert, though, that the hopeful truth is that what is more important is what happens next. You are now a part of us, and we a part of you. May our days together be joyous. And we'll join now in singing hymn number 324, which is our hymn of the month, where "My Free Spirit Onward Leads." Please rise in spirit or body.
There are a number of definitions for the word spiritual out there, but I think a pretty good one, the one that fits best in this context, is from the Oxford English Dictionary and reads, "relating to or affecting the human spirit or soul as opposed to material or physical things." Many other definitions I read out there use the word religion, and I suppose it depends on how you define religion, but I tend to simply define spirituality as our personal connection to something bigger than ourselves. Thanks. When I walked through these doors for the first time 4 or 5 years ago, if somebody would have asked me to tell them about my spiritual journey, I would have struggled with even understanding the question. Having never considered myself spiritual in any sense, the definition I used back then was strictly one of religion, and I am not a religious person. One of the first groups I joined was a book study called Spiritual Ecology. And while I had a working understanding of what the word ecology meant, I was pretty stumped how it could possibly be spiritual. But as I'm sometimes prone to not think too long or hard about jumping into things, I decided to find out, and I joined the group. And I discovered spirituality wasn't really something new to me, but rather only the word was. And it validated this group and all the smart people in it, and the book that we studied called Spiritual Ecology really validated some of my own thoughts and put them into more in focus. And then when I realized that I had indeed been on a spiritual journey my whole life. I just didn't know it. Each of our spiritual journeys are unique to ourselves, and it's our good fortune to have two of our newest members, Matt Ebersole and Shannon Skelton, willing to share their story of their journeys with us today. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Matt Ebersole. Matt comes to us from Wichita, where he was born and raised. He's been in Manhattan since about August and has been coming to the fellowship since about that time, in fact. I've gotten to know Matt a little bit. He's a great guy, and I'm glad he's one of us. And he said that his parents are here, too, today, so welcome.
Good morning, everyone. As you said, my name is Matt. And, you know, in order to properly, I guess, get to the beginning of my spiritual journey, I feel it necessary to, I guess, share a little bit about what life was like before I discovered anything spiritual. When I was much younger, about half my age now, actually, I struggled deeply with depression and some various other mental illnesses, you know, anxiety and blah, 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 blah. You can go on with the list. The diagnosis has changed so many times, I can't even keep up. But, you know, what it came down to in reality was that I was missing something. I was missing a vital aspect of my life. You know, the very first time that I can really ever recall getting in touch with my spiritual side was the first time that I put pen to paper and started to write poetry. But at that point in time, I didn't have the vocabulary to be able to identify it as that. And surprisingly enough, actually, that very first poem that I wrote got published. So it's been kind of an ongoing thing for me since then. So as time went on, you know, I turned to extracurricular activities, you know, drugs and alcohol and stuff. And anyway, coming out the other end of that, you know, is when it really kind of came down to earth and I found out, you know, who I was spiritually speaking. You know, I can't draw from any specific dogma for my beliefs. You know, I can't pick one because there are so many elements in so many different things that just speak to me. You know, I've read Mahatma Gandhi's biography, his autobiography, and it was really just, it was amazing to me to undergo that kind of journey with him, you know, through his writings, because he starts off before he even gets into it, and he says, you know, my purpose in this is to write just a plain old, not dressed up in any way, shape, form, or fashion relation of my life, you know, and beginning from very, very early childhood, you know, he speaks about just such simple things as going out into the village and eating meat when he wasn't supposed to. And there was, you know, a group of kids that would go out and they would eat meat from these places. And, you know, him and his particular spiritual path, you know, that was not allowed. And he speaks about even at an early age being able to feel so wrongly about that. You know, it was bad for him to go out and lie. And I mean, my life is entirely different than that. You know, the things that I did were a lot less mundane, you know, when I went out and got into trouble. But that being said, as it goes on, you know, he went through a lot of struggles himself before he actually even picked up what later turned him into the man that he was, you know, the man who's so famous for these things. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked here. So I brought a little bit of my written word to read to you guys today, because it's actually where I find my connection the strongest, you know, through art and through expression, because something happens with me whenever I get into a creative mode where, you know, I'm not only outputting things, but there are, I don't want to say ideas, but there are energies, you know, that flow into me at the same time as flowing out. And it's just it's an entirely different experience than the rest of my life. So here goes. Come, Come the rain to fall in sheets upon the pane, enframed in wood and metal, settled squarely in the wall, a window against which the wind blows whistling through the gaps, while the water runs in rivulets, revealing fleeting maps of happenstance and gravity. Apathy, it had to be the path of least resistance that ran me straight into depravity. Still, I'm glad to be, by which I mean I'm grateful. Lightning, fateful in its flash, understanding in an instant comes before the crash. Thunder booms and rolls right into me, rattling the room. I recall the taste of future slipping through a loose suture in time. So much more than truth than I dare to define. So small am I beneath a sky asunder. Still, sometimes, the poems, they come easier than words in the way that stones, they fall easier than birds. You see, I think Webster is wrong to claim love as a noun, like some sort of object to be picked up or put down, like people who say that music is nothing but an arrangement of sound. Maybe. Maybe so, though it seems more like a means of expression, like it's meant to convey a much deeper lesson. But after all, what does an answer get you but a much deeper question, like what love is? A verb. Anyway, that's an excerpt from a much larger work of mine that is still in progress. So, that being said, whenever, you know, I sit down and I get in touch with myself, I have a hard time living with making bad past decisions. You know, it's hard for me to move on and say, oh, okay, I can be a good person now, you know, and not feel just totally brought down by stupid things that I've done. You know, and what this does for me is I've been trying to avoid, you know, going on a rant about all the things that I don't believe. So I'm trying to turn this around into the things that I do. You know, I have been searching for a congregation my entire life. I mean, really. And I have investigated so many different paths, from pagan to Judaism to Judeo-paganism to just everything. You know, I've read books and I've attended classes and I've, you know, gone on adventures and all sorts of different things. But one day when I was actually at a function at a Unitarian Universalist church, or fellowship, whatever you want to call it, the building, you know, the building in Salina, you know, I looked up and I saw all of these principles that are basically what I've picked out of all these different spiritual paths that I, you know, I could believe in the principle behind it, not necessarily the dogma or the weird creation stories or, you know, various different things that I just couldn't get on board with. And I looked up and there were these 7 principles on the wall. And I could not believe my eyes. I really could not, you know, because it's, I don't know. It's principles without requirements. You know, nobody, whenever I got here, said that I have to believe this or I have to do this or asked anything from me. You know, they welcomed me and shared with me what they believed, you know, and asked me to do the same, which is extremely fulfilling. And before I take up any more time, I did not notice what time I started. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and end it there.
Thanks very much, Matt. That was great. These all are. These are one of my favorite types of services to come to. So. Now I'd like to introduce Shannon Skelton, and I've never met Shannon, which is my fault, but I'm pretty sure he's a good guy too. Just want to throw that out there. Shannon and his wife, Gretchen Hedrick, and their 2 little ones have lived in Manhattan for about 2 years. Shannon is originally from Tyler, Texas, and then went to that other Kansas university, which I'm not really don't really remember its name. And then the University of Wisconsin-Madison for his PhD. He's a professor at the theater department at K-State. Welcome, Shannon.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. We all define the phrase spiritual journey in unique and personal ways. For some reason, when I hear spiritual journey, perhaps fed by my religious education or through images forged by pop culture, I imagine a heavily robed wanderer adrift among the dunes and shifting sands of the Sahara, silently trudging toward some elusive destination. That is certainly not me. Yet memories of my own journey come back to me through equally distinct images, as I have returned to a long-ignored book only to open it and have yellowed Polaroids flutter out from its dusty pages. The images are these: a scribbled note on a wall, shaking columns, the curvature of a fence, and a bowler's cap. The scribbled note on a wall came from my junior year in high school, during a conversation with an older student, one of my best friends, who was steeped in all things cool to me. We had a conversation about the beat author Jack Kerouac. I think he had recently been name-checked in Rolling Stone, but regardless of the reason, we didn't know much about him, so we decided to seek out his works. Not surprisingly, my friend Charlie and I discovered that the small Texas town in which we were in did not stock Jack Kerouac or Allen Ginsberg in the public library. That Christmas, my friend presented me with a copy of Kerouac's Dharma Bums. The Dharma Bums follows the Kerouac stand-in as he explores the wonders of backpacking, mountain climbing, and Buddhism. Through this novel, I learned of Buddhism's four noble truths. One, suffering exists. Two, suffering arises from attachment to desires. Three, suffering ceases when attachment to desire ceases. And four, freedom from suffering is possible by practicing the Eightfold Path. I scribbled this down on a piece of paper and hung it on my wall, and its wisdom stays with me every day, namely that life is suffering. It is a reality of existence, yet there are methods in which to alleviate that suffering for yourself and ways in which you can work as a community to push back against forces that cause the suffering in others. The second image I presented was of columns shaking. The columns I'm speaking of were located in a megachurch, once again in that small East Texas town of my childhood, located in the piney woods, not too far from the Louisiana border. The white columns of the sanctuary of this megachurch were quivering because a preacher was blaring the grinding guitar chords of the heavy metal band Judas Priest. Dragged by a friend whose parents forced him to go, I found myself in a weekend retreat of sorts about the evils of the devil's music. Rock and roll. My friend Jed, whose parents were concerned about his recent tastes in music, convinced him to attend. As a supportive friend, who was certainly not a Southern Baptist, but rather a lazy Episcopalian, I loved the pomp of Sunday services and was entranced by stained glass, I decided to enter into this megachurch. It was massive. This was the main church for all of East Texas. It was broadcast on television every Sunday morning. The baptism area was a full-size pool. This was very foreign to me. I noticed no stained glass, but I noticed a lot of large video screens, so that was quite surprising to me. Anyhow, into the sanctuary we went, and the preacher cranked the volume of this Judas Priest song, melting our brains and faces in its volume and aggression. After stopping the song, the preacher began to speak about the devil's music and the evil located in the grooves of vinyl discs that promoted carnality, supernaturalism, intoxication, and many other wonderful things. What followed was a weekend of dogmatic takedowns of and uninformed madness regarding rock and roll. Through seminars and slideshow presentations, we learned about the usual subjects, Ozzy Osbourne, Alice Cooper, and the like, but also learned about the poisonous influence of those shock rockers, Elvis Presley and the Beatles. Apparently, Elvis was evil because he introduced sexuality to the masses through his pelvis wiggling, and the Beatles because they advocated non-Western religions. And that's it. The fall of American society, Elvis and the Beatles. Even to my eighth grade mind, I knew something was amiss. In our breakout sessions, when leaders ranted about the downward spiral from rock music to masturbation to heroin use and then satanic worship, I knew I'd stumbled upon something new to me. I didn't know the term at the time, but I had just been exposed to dogma in religion. Like I said, I was raised a lazy Episcopalian. We didn't tell anyone what to listen to or watch or read. So when I skipped out of the sessions at that Southern Baptist megachurch and sat alone in the hallway, terrified that some Baptist would find me and force me back into the classroom, I contemplated how religion can be used to alter and damage minds. That afternoon at the kitchen table, I told my mother about the experience. She smiled and said, "There's a reason I have never stepped foot into that church." And then she said something incredibly liberating to me. She said, "We must all find our own way." Not too long after that, my parents gave me the choice to continue attending the Episcopalian church or to stop. I drifted away from it with no animosity, really, but with the realization that organized religion centered around dogma was damaging to the soul. So though my weekend at the God of Rock workshop is humorous in retrospect, I remember that time with a smile, knowing I learned about the nature of some religions. That, and because the preacher played a decent amount of evil rock music, I expanded my knowledge of some pretty cool bands. The third image is of a curved fence, a high fence that has a unique curvature at the top, almost like a swooping S. I'm standing staring at the top of the fence. I'm in Poland on a rainy day. I'm at Auschwitz. There's so much to be said about my time visiting the death camps. The experience reaches down into the unknowable center of my self and forces everyone to face the evil of humanity. Humans possess the capacity for great evil, and not just humans who occupy positions of power in society. Rather, all humans possess this capacity. The curved fences of Auschwitz-Birkenau haunted me for months after my visit, and I found myself scribbling the curvature of the fence, sketching the lines of fences that seemed to extend for miles. So life is suffering, religion can be harmful, and humans are capable of evil. But the final image is a bowler cap. In Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot, two homeless men, dressed like Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp character, complete with bowler caps, wait on a lonely road for the arrival of the mysterious Godot. At the end of each day, a boy arrives and informs Vladimir and Estragon that Godot will not appear that day, but may come tomorrow. And in one of the most famous moments from theater history, Vladimir and Estragon look at one another and they say they must go, but they remain unmoving. End of play. There has been a ridiculous amount of scholarly treatises defended and monographs published speculating on the nature of this Godot figure. Who is he? Why do Vladimir and Estragon wait for him? Why do they not move? Will Vladimir and Estragon believe that their life will be given meaning by the arrival of Godot? But what they do not realize is that their life has already gained meaning through friendship, counseling, and support of one another. They help one another, they humor each other, and quite simply, they love one another. They are best friends and have found meaning in their own lives through communion with another person, not through the dream of the arrival of Godot. But they retain hope that everything will one day be revealed to them and explained to them. But in the meantime, they have each other, and that is where they find the meaning of their own spirituality in another person. So my personal journey is this. Life is suffering, religion can be harmful, humans are capable of great evil, and that hope and salvation can often be located in our everyday friendships. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Shannon. That was great. Our closing hymn today is number 360, Here We Have Gathered. In closing, I'd like to share these words. May we leave this place seeking an uncharted and freely chosen way to wholeness, knowing we have companions along the way. Thanks.